Grow CFO is where finance leaders grow together. Join thousands of like-minded professionals using Grow CFO to access the combined knowledge and experience of the finance leader community. You can join us today, growcfo.net. Hello and welcome to the Grow CFO show. I'm your host, Kevin Appleby. And today I've got with me Luigi Testa, who is a very experienced CFO from Link Squares. Luigi, welcome to the Grow CFO show.
Thanks, Kevin. It's great to be here. Appreciate the time.
Luigi, tell us something about you. You've obviously had a journey that's got you to CFO, got you to Link Squares. Give us a flavor of what's been involved.
Yeah, it's been a great journey. I started at the company when we were only a couple million of revenue, and now we're well above that, grown over 100% for the last handful of years since I've been there, even before that. What got me here, a number of things. I think the two founders I've known for a handful of years, two great guys, Chris and Vishal, and really love the business and the idea in the product market fit, and kept tabs in the business as it grew, got to a few million of ARR. We realized, you know, these really something special here, and decided to jump on as CFO in the business. I knew some of the investors as well in the company, so it felt like a natural sort of progression. But before that, I've worked in strategic finance, FP&A. I started my career in venture capital right out of college and got a degree in finance. So great next step for me. I like technology a lot. I like finance. I went into venture and then started working for companies that were private equity backed and venture backed. You get more involved and understand how a business operates and understand how you actually build a business, what works, what doesn't work, and ultimately landed at Link Squares as CFO. And my prior role, I was at a private equity backed technology company in the real estate space. I came in, 20-year-old company, I came in to help clean things up, get it more in a position where we could grow the business organically and also grow it through acquisition. So we built an M&A platform and headed up corporate development for a handful of years there until had a wonderful opportunity to move over to Link Squares. And the rest is history. It seems like it was so long ago, but time has certainly flown where we've come along in our journey, raised a whole bunch of rounds of financing.
Tell me a little bit more about Link Squares. What does the company actually do?
Link Squares, we're a legal tech company, an AI company, Boston-based. You know, essentially, what we do is we help legal teams move their business forward faster by automating really simple tasks that they do on a regular basis, like contract review, analyzing, understanding their contracts. And outside of contract, we do a lot for them too, things like project management. You think about all the work that a legal team has to get done. How do they prioritize? And so we help them with that as well. At the end of the day, we want them to be able to be more strategic in how they run their business and be more efficient. And this is a tool that allows them to do so. And I think, you know, this is a CFO podcast. So if we think about it from a CFO's perspective, if I were to use NetSuite as an example, a lot of companies out there use NetSuite or QuickBooks to close their books on a regular basis. You would never close your books, even at like $2 million size company. You would never really do that in Excel. And attorneys are doing that right now. In-house counsels are doing that right now, effectively on the legal side. So we're giving them the tools to get out of Excel, closing their books, into a real system that makes them more efficient and the process repeatable and easy.
Brilliant, brilliant. So quite a market, very well-defined customer, great tech product, and AI in it as well, powering it along. So you said as you introduced yourself that there's a great growth journey there. So you must have navigated quite a lot of growth there. Tell me a little bit about navigating that growth.
Sure. It's certainly been a journey with a lot of ups and downs, certainly more ups and downs. And I think in general, you can create a plan and don't ever expect that plan to go exactly the way that you had set out. So being able to pivot as you go along the journey and understand what makes sense for the business is really key. And I think as I look at the business as a CFO, it's really key that you are able to scale along with the business. So as the business is growing, making sure that business doesn't outgrow you. And some of the ways you can do that are leveraging technology, bringing in great experts into the finance org in particular. I'm not a CPA by training. I grew up in kind of the more of the finance, FP&A, strategic finance world. So, you know, making sure when we get to a certain scale that we have CPAs in the company that can do the more technical things, that was really key for me. So hiring great people to come along the journey with you and to contribute and to build value in the business and also in the finance org has been a really great part of it. Outside the finance org that we could sort of go down and talk about, I'm also happy to do that.
Yeah. To what extent do you get involved in implementing the growth strategy as the CFO?
From a lot of different angles, I think about the modern day CFO, and I think initially call it 10 years ago, a lot of the folks that were CFOs were accountants by training, right? So job was really come in, make sure you close the books, make sure that there's cash in the bank, make sure people get paid. It was really finance centric, finance focused. It still is. Finance is obviously a huge part of the CFO's job, but I think that is just table stakes. You need to make sure the trains are running, and that's assume that it's just going to get done. But outside of that, it's playing a very strategic role in helping figure out what the direction of the business is going to be. And that part of that is figuring out when are we going to fundraise, figuring out when are we going to invest in building a new product? When are we going to invest more in hiring, you know, more salespeople to do more revenue? When is the right time to do that? And I think a lot of it comes back to the CFO, because you're ultimately going to be tasked with how can I measure an investment that I'm making and understand if I'm going to get ROI out of it? And then if I'm not, where can I be accountable and where can I pivot? And helping the company and the team do that, that's a big part of the job. I think I look at the finance group in many companies and I see them as the GPS for the business. We're not running the company. That's the entire management team's duty to do, but we're providing a lot of guidance through data and through looking at trends and history and helping figure out what the future could hold.
So do you think that FP&A background is something that gives you an advantage as a CFO in that process?
I think your strengths and your experiences, you just need to play them up to and leverage them to based on what your personality traits are and what you want to be. For this business in particular, we're a SaaS company. And as far as the complexity on the accounting side, there's no inventory. So it's relatively low and easy to get this business started. So I think on the FP&A side, we're really fast growing. We need to be really calculated in how we think about the next moves that we're going to make and how we can show that we're progressing at the level we should. And when's the right time to hit the gas? When's the right time to slow things down? That's all really important. So I'd say, yeah, having an FP&A background has been super helpful. And one of the companies that I was a part of went public, one of the companies, my last one, Building Engines, we got acquired by a strategic. So I think having those experiences are really important. I would say having been an FP&A is not just the key. It's more of what actually happened while you were there. Because I could have been an FP&A and just been fly on the wall at, you know, a really large company and taken all that in. I don't think it would be as helpful if I'd had that role coming into Link Squares based on just the variety of things that I've been able to see.
I often think there's an interesting little dichotomy there between, you know, being the team member in a very big company and probably doing a lot of routine things where perhaps the name of the company is very prestigious versus going for a smaller company where you're more involved in a lot of things. I think you see more of those experiences that shape you.
Absolutely. Yeah, I agree. I think it's certainly about what kind of experience you've had. And I think a lot of these large companies are great because they provide excellent training programs, but I think they also provide a ton of resources to get the job done. And when you're at a $2 million company, which I started Link Squares as a $2 million company, you don't really have all the resources at your disposal. So you're doing HR, you're doing IT, you're packing up boxes to move. Right, you're trying to figure out what's the best use of your time and when you have 150% of your day already committed to doing something. So at the end of the day, you want to be able to leverage yourself and build the most value in the business as possible with the resources that you have. And I think where the big company experience comes in is as you grow and scale, you need to adopt more mature processes and ways to get things done, because the way that running the finance org and the entire company is entirely different than we were in 2020 when I started.
Yeah. And I think a lot of our audience will resonate with that position. You're in a $2 million company, having to be jack of all trades, do lots of different stuff that you wouldn't probably associate with CFO. I guess one of the challenges there, Luigi, is breaking out of that and repositioning yourself as the in the CFO role. How did you find that went? Was that an easy transition?
That's a great question. I think of it as a challenge. I think it's really developing an appreciation for all the things that need to happen in the business for it to function. Did I want to be packing up boxes when we moved our office because we kept outgrowing it? Not necessarily, but you really develop an appreciation for, look at this is how far we've come. This is really great. And these are all the other things that a business needs in order to function that nobody really thinks about. So from that aspect, I really like it. You're earning your stripes as you go along. And then you reach a certain point of success within the business. The company's hit a certain revenue threshold where you physically and from an ROI standpoint, it doesn't really make sense to do all those tasks. And if you keep doing it, something's going to break and it's probably going to be you in some other parts of the business. So knowing when is the right time to get out and hire and build up other teams to support those functions. Like when I started, like I was saying, we didn't have an IT function and today we do. If we had to continue over the next couple of years of me supporting and running IT, we'd be a total disaster. We're a technology internet company. It'd be really bad if I was the one that was helping head that up. So I think, you know, generally knowing when the right time to make a move on scaling up certain functions, that's really important. And you can also do the opposite in some cases. If you scale up too quickly, then you can also find yourself in a bad position. So it's really about balancing the resources and understanding where you're going to get the most bang for your buck, especially in the early days. Your resources are definitely not unlimited. And then as you get more mature in your company's life cycle, the amount of scrutiny that goes into what you're doing with your resources is a lot higher because the investment is a lot higher from an investor's point of view. So it doesn't get easier as you get bigger. The stakes get higher and the treadmill starts running faster. It's just a different kind of experience.
I always think that you're about that $2 million company that's the CFO or the finance leader, because a lot of folk at that level aren't necessarily referred to as the CFO. You get the jobs that nobody else wants to do. You naturally inherit your facilities management is a classic one.
That's right.
Yeah. Picking up the IT bits, you might have this great team developing the product, especially if it's a SaaS product, but no, running your own IT, the back office systems, that falls to the finance leader normally because nobody else wants to do it. So yeah, it's a challenge, keeping all that on and realizing the right time to step away. But thinking of that journey, you're going from that $2 million company to where it is today. You must have been through a few fundraisers.
Sure. As soon as I came in, we were raising our Series A. It's a $14.5 million round right before COVID, all the way to our Series C when we raised $100 million at the beginning of 2022. And those two fundraises were very different. In Series A, when you're a couple million of ARR, you have limited data, limited history, limited ideas of, an investor has limited ideas of what the business can really do. They're investing in the team at that point. And
biggest chance on the vision.
Exactly. They're taking a chance on the vision. That those folks are taking the most risk out of any of the investors in the different successive rounds. Each round is less risk, obviously. So the story and the fundraise and the pitch is a lot different in a Series A than it is in a Series C. And I think there's a lot of sort of checks and balances on, do I believe this company has the right product market fit? Do I believe the team is a team that can take it to 50 million, 100 million, even 10 million, right? So doing diligence on that is really key for an investor. And those are some of the things that they look into. But I would say one of the things that's very common in all the fundraisers that we've done and why we've been very successful is, and this is even, it predates me, and I had a wonderful person working on the finance team before I got there, and she did an absolute fantastic job of keeping everything pristine, books, great notes, everything was in order. So when you're doing diligence and you have everything in order, it just eliminates any doubt that the company is able to be, if your house is in order, they're going to wonder less about other things, right? If you can't produce basic financials, they're going to be like, oh, if these people can't produce financials, what else can't they do? So having those things in a good spot is really key in all your fundraisers. And one of the great things about our Series C fundraisers, not to jump too much around, we've been leveraging a tool that we built called Analyze. Link Squares has a tool called Analyze that allows customers to see what's inside their contracts. And a lot of times during a fundraise, what does an investor want to see? They want to see how many client contracts you have, if these contracts are all pretty standard, if there's different variances in the language, are they actually good contracts? So being able to produce any number of those contracts and report on what are the key terms in a matter of seconds was actually hugely impactful, especially in our Series C, because the volume just keeps on increasing. We did our Series C in under 70 days, and a lot of the success and speediness of it was because we had amazing tools like ours, and because we built really good processes around FP&A and accounting, just to have all the answers just ready to go. And we also went through the last two fundraisers, the investors hired outside firms like PwC to do a quality of earnings and just an overall audit on the business to make sure what they are investing in, there weren't any hidden surprises. And we were able to pass those with flying colors. So it goes back to, I think, one of the really important key themes that I tell a lot of folks that are in fundraising is you're not waking up one day and saying, I'm going to go do a fundraise. Let me get the house in order. It's a discipline that you need to make sure you're carrying out every day. So when you get to that point, it makes it a lot easier and more streamlined. And you can't really go back and recreate everything when you decide to do a fundraise to be neat and tidy and ready for investors.
So even if you're not immediately planning a fundraise, get your house in order now is lesson one.
There's no reason not to. And even your existing investors, they should expect and demand it. And if you aren't giving that to them, if I'm on the other side of the table, I would be very skeptical of what else is the team not doing.
Yeah. So we've talked about financials. We've talked about having clean data. We've talked about those tools that you've been able to use to analyze contracts. Just a thought there. Have you thought those tools are primarily based at the legal market? Have you thought of maybe there's another use of those tools to other CFOs going through the process that you are?
100%. I wouldn't be a good CFO of a legal tech company if I didn't think that. And we're actually using the tools in finance to run things like procurement. And a lot of times when we get to right now is a really competitive time in the software industry. A lot of companies are doing budget cuts. So ultimately, a lot of times it comes down to the CFO signing off on something from our customers wanting to do business with us. And occasionally I'll get on the phone with one of the CFOs that we're working with and you don't have to talk about what other areas besides just legal can this product serve. And I go down the path of how do we use it? Well, fundraising, it's hugely important. But day to day, we use it for procurement. How are we signing up vendors? How are we making sure vendors are legitimate? How are we making sure we have all the right payment terms? How do we make it like a great assembly line of how to get a contract signed? So not just from a legal standpoint, but from a finance standpoint. We want to make sure if somebody's requesting something, say in sales, they want to add 10 new tools. How do we know it's in the budget or not? If it's not in the budget, then we're not going to approve it. But things are moving fast when you're growing really fast and it's easy to forget things. But if you have a really well-built out process and you're leveraging tools like we leverage Link Squares, it makes things a lot easier. So I love using it for procurement. It actually, from an efficiency standpoint, we can get a lot further. Instead of investing in more headcount, we're leveraging technology and that will certainly scale as the business grows.
So 70 days start to finish for a Series C.
Yeah.
That's impressive. Now, go back to before that 70 days started ticking. Were you already building relationships up, communicating with the potential investors? Tell me a little bit about that process.
As I think about becoming a CFO and how did I get there and what's a great path, this will connect in a second here. I think if you're not spending time investing your network and networking, you're making a huge mistake. So how did I get to Link Squares? Well, I had the two founders of my network. I had the investors of Link Squares, my network. And on an ongoing basis, I'm having calls with investors in the company and outside the company, just as check-ins, talk about how the business is doing, talk about how we're thinking about the future, talk about how we're thinking about our results from the past. What are the new products that we're sort of noodling on to introduce to the market? Doing those regular check-ins is very powerful because you build a relationship. And then when you're ready to raise that round of financing, you're not just calling a bunch of folks cold and ask them to write you a check. You have a relationship. So in some cases, they're coming to me and saying, hey, is now the right time? Can we talk about writing you a check? And that's the best thing that could possibly happen because you both know each other. You have an existing relationship. You understand how they want to work with the business. That's a really important relationship. It's not just about the money. It's what is in the partnership that's valuable to the company and helping bring the business forward in a meaningful way. So we certainly weigh that over, can this person just write the check? And the only way to really establish that and get that sense of, oh, this will be a good partner is to build a relationship with them before. And it starts years before you sign a term sheet.
But what practical things do you do, Luigi, to keep those relationships warm?
It's just making sure you water the plants in the garden. I mean, if you talk to somebody and you think they're a good person and you have them in your network, you met them once or twice. Make sure you reach out to them every now and then and say, hey, do you want to grab coffee? You want to catch up for 10 or 20 minutes? It's like really simple things that I think help you maintain those relationships. And it's also doing something for them. Hey, I talked to a CFO at this company the other day. It seemed like it would be a good fit for somebody like you who invests in XYZ SaaS companies. How about I make an introduction for you? And then you're also helping somebody else out. So I think it's about helping folks out when you don't need something and connecting folks in a way that's meaningful and impactful for them, because Nobody starts out with a network pre-built. They have to get it built somewhere. So returning the favors and work that other people have done for you when you were in that same position is really key. And I'm a big believer in everything comes full circle at some point. So that's why I continue to do things the way that I do. And outside of just the networking and fundraising point of view, it's a great place to build almost like your personal advisory board too. So a lot of uses for it.
Brilliant. I run module 5 in our future CFO program at Grow CFO. We talk all about networking, and I think you've highlighted a lot of things that I teach in that module. One of the things I do right at the end of the session is, right, now we spent 2 hours talking about networking. Now write down the names of 3 or 4 people that you haven't spoken to in a while and promise me that in the next week, you're going to pick the phone up and call them.
Absolutely. It's almost like it's part of the job. That should be this. I'm going to talk to 3 or 4 folks every week that I haven't checked in with in a while. And if you just get in the habit of doing that on an ongoing basis, it makes things so much easier.
Brilliant. So thinking back to that fundraise, Luigi, and we've done this in 70 days. Due diligence is a big part of that process. Now, there are always questions in due diligence that come and hit you from left field. Did you experience many of those questions you weren't expecting or quite prepared for, didn't quite have the answer for?
In due diligence, so you should go into due diligence having a preset number of items in your data room that are probably going to cover 80% of what investors ask you. And you're going to do your pitch with the CEO of the company and sort of run through the business. And they're going to either going to be excited about it or they're going to pass. They're going to say, this is not for me, which is fine. Most of the investors pass on a business, right? And then you get to that next phase. At that point, it's time to say, okay, this first day went really great. I like what I'm hearing. I think we can get married, but I want to learn a little bit more about you. So a lot of times it becomes financial, especially in the series C or B. So when they want to learn more about you, that's when you get then the opportunity exists to let them into your data room and understand, like, how is the sausage really made? How are the financials looking, right? And take all the raw data, do whatever you want to do to it. Every investor has their own way of analyzing companies. They build models around doing it. So they're going to take your raw data. They're going to run it through that. Then they're going to ask you a whole bunch of questions if they're still interested. But I think if you have a really good data room with really simple things like your customer list, and it should be anonymized when you start out, your financials, your history of, if you're a SaaS company, what's your ARR waterfall, like things like that, that puts you at a huge advantage because any interested party is going to ask for those things right off the bat. So giving them that right away makes things a lot easier. You can shortcut a lot of the questions and analysis and back and forth of requests. Once they've done their analysis, then you're going to sit down with them again. And there's a whole host of other questions. And so to circle back to the original question, is there anything that hit me out of left field? I would say no, because I would say 85, 90% of the questions you get following that initial phase of diligence, they're all the same. So there was no question that was asked me. Oh, I have no idea what this is. But I will say in some cases, an investor will ask you for a certain piece of diligence or a certain analysis on the business. And I think it's more of an opportunity to have a conversation if it's something you don't have and say, well, actually, I know you're asked for X, but this is not actually how we run the business. We gave you the raw data. This is how we think about it. And that gives them a perspective on how you actually run the business and how this is more applicable and valuable to the way that they're thinking about it. And I would say as far as metrics, you should never create metrics that are just for investors. The metrics that are actually for you, for the company to run and be accountable for off of. If you're creating metrics as a way to please investors and make them happy, it's like a completely wrong way to do it. You should be doing it so you can run your business effectively. And generally, those two things should align if you're doing it the right way. So yeah, I wouldn't say we got hit out of left field by anything. It's just more of how much time do you want to invest with each investor and into the relationship, into the conversation based on their level of interest. I think there's also a tendency, especially for earlier stage companies, to go way overboard with diligence because it's like information overload. The more they give, the better it's going to be. But if it's tight and crisp and it's not a ton of things, I think you're in an even better spot than giving additional things that'll make things take longer and ask and warrant more questions because they don't understand things. That was a lot in that sort of blurb, but I think I got you back to where you needed to be.
Yeah, good answer. I like that one of spinning it around. When the question comes in, you perhaps haven't got the data for it. Spin that back around to, no, but this is how we run the company. So you can go deeper into the understanding.
Right.
So anything else you'd say to a prospective CFO maybe going in looking at their first fundraise. Any other tips for getting yourself set up to do that successfully?
I would say going to your first fundraise, you shouldn't see it as a very daunting moment. It's actually a moment for you to thrive. And this is the exact reason that you got hired as a CFO in the business to do things like this. So it's really an opportunity for you to shine. It's really an opportunity for you to show the business in a very positive light, show all the great accomplishments that you've achieved, you being the business or you as the business. If you look at it from that point of view, it becomes almost fun. Like, I actually like fundraising. I think it's like a really exciting time. There's a lot going on. You're talking to a lot of people. You're learning a lot about different firms. So I think if you approach it from that point of view, it makes the journey a lot more fun and less stressful. If you approach it from the point of view, oh, we need to do this because we're out of cash and the business is going to die, then it's just not as fun. So it's really, I think it's about your mindset and your approach to some degree as you're thinking about a fundraising. I would say the earlier fundraisers are harder as a CFO and also for investors because there's less historical data to go off of. So it's really about making sure that your forecasts are crisp, that you understand all the unit economics that you're putting into them. Because a lot of times what investors will do is they'll go through your models and they'll ask you questions about your assumptions. And that's like the glue that effectively holds these models together. And that's what they're underwriting your ability to forecast the future to some degree and also it to be believable. So to the extent that you can do that, I think it's really key. And in a lot of cases in early stage fundraising, you don't necessarily know, but you can get to a lot of these assumptions by using good logic. And that's what investors are looking for, is making sure that you have good logic and you have good business acumen to run the business. Because they do know, like a five-year forecast for a Series A company, the likelihood of you hitting that five-year forecast is pretty close to zero at the end of the day. But it's, do you have the right logic and discipline to get there and then to pivot it as you go along? And that's what you're also demonstrating during your fund.
I'd say at the state the global economy is in and uncertainty and so on, you're very unlikely to get much beyond the first year of that forecast.
Even for a big company,
the forecast gives you a view, gives you a set of assumptions that are valid at the moment, and maybe allows you to say, well, look, these are the things that might happen. This is where we might have to pivot, so on and so forth. Yeah. Luigi, that brings us really talking about the kind of the economic climate at the moment. 2024, what do you see as the role of the CFO? How's it changing?
I've certainly been talking about this with a lot of my CFO peers. I think the role of the CFO is shifted from just, especially in technology, how do you grow as fast as you possibly can to how can you grow in a healthy way and have the right balance of efficiency? And the companies that can do that will get rewarded the most. The ones that are just growing and not worrying about efficiency are not going to be rewarded in the round of cash ultimately. So the role of the CFO, I think, changed pretty significantly last year in 2023 when, you know, we had some macro headwinds. Every business did, just different things going on globally that made sort of the buying experience for customers a little bit harder. It introduced budget cuts and, you know, people doing reductions in forces. So it just made the general selling environment harder. And then when there's stress on that, it puts stress on the rest of the business to be more efficient, to do more with less. And a lot of times it comes back to the CFO, where the question's like, well, the company needs to figure out how to do more with less, and you need to be the sort of the project manager to help us do that. And it's about really taking a step away from being the bean counter, the accountant, or the CPA, making sure the books are done in the business, and getting involved in the other parts of the business to help your peers on the team, your person that runs sales, your person that runs product, understand, first of all, like what they have. How many resources have I accumulated over the last handful of years when we were growing really fast? What is the output that we're getting? And then looking forward, how do I get more out of those same resources? And how can I add as little as possible and still achieve the same level of output? And I'm not talking about just sales. I'm talking about engineering. How do I get the same amount of code, if not more, out of the same resources year over year when I know I'm going to have to maintain more products and I'm also going to have to introduce new products? So that's a really important key thing for the modern day CFO, is that efficiency component is tremendously important. And if you talked about profitability and efficiency in 2021, a lot of investors just didn't care about it. And now it's the opposite. Now they care about how do you maintain that healthy balance in order to stay relevant in the business. So I think, you know, the CFO has a really good pulse on that. As you're talking to investors, you're able to see the numbers, and more importantly, not just seeing the numbers, but
what story does it tell in the long term, and what trajectory are we putting ourselves on? And in today's environment, you want to have the most optionality possible. So if you're hitting the gas too hard in one area and you're not able to pull back, then that makes things a lot harder for you in the future if things change or if the economy stays the way it does.
Yeah, I guess that the one thing that allows us all over the business to do more with the same resources is AI coming into things in a big way.
Absolutely. We're an AI company. AI just wasn't cool a couple of years ago. So we were the nerds that liked AI before it was cool. And now every investor conference that I've been to, every CFO that I've talked with, there's some part of the discussion that involves AI. So it's great to be an AI company today, and having done it for the last 8 years is even more amazing. Yeah. Getting a head start is fantastic. I think AI is great. I'll put it under one big umbrella, but when I think about AI in a business, I think about it as your ability to create leverage. So leverage and efficiency. And how does that happen? It's a way for you to create more automation. It's a way for you to not do the things that are mundane tasks and things that are on the factory assembly line. How do you find a machine to do that for you? And that's the answer that AI provides. So you can get tremendous efficiency gains using AI in a business if done the right way. If you don't do it the right way, the opposite thing will happen, right? So you need to be really careful and calculated with what tools you're leveraging and where you're leveraging them. I would never use a tool to write our board decks. You just can't do that. But for something like accounts payable, that makes a ton of sense. Like, why not use AI there? Because it's a transactional, workflow.
But I must admit that just this week, as we're recording this, I've got a hold of Microsoft Copilot Pro for the first time. Because that's really just literally in the last 2 weeks been released to everybody publicly. And right. I'm certainly finding that making a big difference with certain things that I'm doing within Grow CFO. And literally today, writing a briefing document for our next best practice accelerator, it was lovely not to necessarily start with a blank document, that at least you could say to some prompt, oh, this is roughly what I want to write. Can you give me a first draft, please?
Absolutely.
Yes.
It's all about being able to elevate your status a little bit and get some time back to work on more important things, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. So where do you think you'll be in the next 12, 24 months, Luigi? You see much difference in your role coming up?
I think we'll continue along the path of creating more efficiency and using that efficiency to get more leverage out of the business. But I think for me personally, it's about understanding like what are those levers and what are the things that I need to track, and what are the things in the future that are going to change that I should be looking at and understanding it as far as leading indicators to where we should be hitting the gas harder, where we should be trying to find more efficiency. And this is a new thing in the last, call it 18 months in most businesses, which is like we were just talking about getting more efficiency out of things. So I think the next 2 years, it's going to be more of the same. And especially as a company matures, it's not about creating a couple $1 million of ARR, then 4 or 5. It's about, okay, you have this great business, you have this great sales team that the company has built and scaled. How do you continue to scale that part of the business and make sure that you don't hit sort of a terminal velocity of only being able to do the same output year over year? How do you continue to grow it, but grow it in an efficient and healthy way? Because at the end of the day, like a lot of tech companies, especially in the early days, they're losing money. Investors are not investing in a business because they want it to lose money for years and years. At some point, it needs to be a profitable business. So how do you pivot the business at some point in the future to get to that point? I can see that's certainly something that Link Squares, we think about. The market for us, for Link Squares in particular, is a huge market. Every company in the world has contracts. So therefore, any company could be a customer of ours. So we want to capture as much of that market as we possibly can. And there's no intention to slow things down so much that we can't continue to grow and keep capturing the market. But we do need to make sure that we are able to leverage efficiency, and that's to tie it back. And that's something that I'm going to continue to focus on, and that I think our investors, current and future, will be very focused on. So it does tie back to how can you deliver the most enterprise value for the business as you grow, as you progress through your states of maturity. Part of that is what is the market demanding and asking for? And part of it is, what is the right thing to do for the business today? And then that's going to change next year. It's going to probably change the year after.
Luigi, brilliant. Exciting times.
Absolutely.
Every success in all of that. And Luigi, thank you very much for being this week's guest on the Grow CFO Show.
It was my pleasure. I really appreciate the time, Kevin. It was great to chat with you, and I look forward to hearing about this after.